Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a smell of oil hanging over the beaches along the Gulf Coast now. Dead turtles, doomed fishermen, and no idea yet exactly how or when the crude oil belching up into the Gulf of Mexico will be stopped. It was comforting to think Exxon Valdez-scale disasters might be behind us. The worst of this calamity may still be ahead, and much worse. This hour on Point, the still unfolding disaster in the Gulf. You can join the conversation. Can you believe that this spill has gotten so out of hand and could still go on for months to come? Could this be a turning point in American attitudes toward energy? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's President Obama yesterday in Venice, Louisiana, giving a grave assessment of the BP oil spill.
We're dealing with a massive and potentially unprecedented environmental disaster. The oil that is still leaking from the well could seriously damage the economy and the environment of our Gulf states, and it could extend for a long time. It could jeopardize the livelihoods of thousands of Americans who call this place home.
Joining me now from New Orleans for the latest is Jeffrey Ball, environment editor for the Wall Street Journal. Jeffrey, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Any news of luck so far with some of these near-term approaches, efforts to try and stop the oil gushing out of the seafloor?
Well, there are two potential encouraging signs, neither of them huge. One is that BP said yesterday that one tactic that it's trying appears to be having some success, and that is injecting chemical dispersant into the water down deep below at the source of the oil leak, and also spraying the dispersant on the surface of the water. This is a chemical that's intended to break up the oil, and BP says that appears to be doing well. Secondly, one of the big problems in the past few days down here has been really horrific weather, which has made it very difficult for people to get out and lay what are called booms. These are plastic pipes that are laid out along the shore with the intent of stopping the oil from coming into very ecologically sensitive marshlands. To the degree that people were able to get out recently, the booms were largely broken up. The weather has cleared a bit today, and so people are going out and doing some of that, and so that's encouraging. But at the end of the day, the oil still continues to leak, and there are a lot of attempts being made to try to resolve that, but they're not working at this point.
Jeffrey, what are the best case, worst case scenarios at this point for the oil hitting the shore?
Well, the answer seems to shift daily. I mean, the situation is that this is a massive, massive oil slick in the Gulf of Mexico, on the order of more than 1,000 square miles. It's floating out there, and for the past several days, it's been buffeted around by shifting winds. Some of the oil, according to the federal government, has touched the shoreline in far southeastern Louisiana, where the Mississippi feeds into the Gulf of Mexico. But it's unclear where the bulk of this slick is going to move, and the latest maps suggest that it's moving up toward Mississippi and Alabama. Essentially, the answer is that everyone from the tip of the Mississippi River in southeastern Louisiana all the way over essentially to Pensacola, Florida, is on edge.
We've even read that there's a chance the Gulf Stream could catch it and take it around the tip of Florida and up the East Coast.
Well, that's interesting. I think the answer is that, you know, one thing one learns about this is that this is largely subject to the vicissitudes of the wind, and people haven't been able to predict that very well.
Is there a sense of doom at this point? I mean, it's hard to tell from a distance. You know, we're hearing a lot of people saying it's done. The oil is there, and sooner or later, it's going to be in the marshes. It's going to be on the beaches, and the booms aren't going to stop it. The dispersants aren't going to disperse it.
Well, yes, there's a sense of doom here. I mean, there's an increasing sense that this is a potential ecological disaster on a massive scale. One thing that that BP said yesterday was that BP does not know how much oil, in fact, is coming out of the pipe at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, a mile down. So, you know, there were initial estimates that this was coming out at the rate of 1,000 barrels of oil a day. That was raised then to 5,000 barrels of oil today. Government officials were talking yesterday about much, much higher numbers. And at the end of the day, it seems clear that no one really knows, but it's very big. This is starting to be discussed in the context of the scale of the Exxon Valdez spill, potentially, in 1989 in Alaska. And, I think the sense is that it is inevitable that this is going to wash up somewhere. And then the question becomes twofold. First, how successful can people be in trying to prevent it from really getting into very, very sensitive places like marshes? And second of all, how quickly can they stop this thing so that the slick doesn't get even larger than it is?
As bad as it is, there's a lot of talk that it could get much, much worse, that even some of these solutions could take months to execute. And they're looking at some what sound like, you know, pretty risky maneuvers to try and stop this. Though, of course, we can understand why. But I'm reading here that they're bringing in the BP's bringing their senior VP from Africa to try and go down and actually sort of slice open, as I understand it, the pipe right at the wellhead and put a new blowout preventer on there, which, if it worked, could stop it cold. And if it didn't work, could let the full volume of oil from that underground supply gush into the Gulf.
Yeah, I mean, BP is clearly trying everything that it thinks is plausible, it says. This is uncharted territory. There have been large oil spills before, but the fact that this is so deep down sets this one apart. You walked through a lot of the things that people are trying, that BP and others, the authorities are trying here. I mean, they're trying essentially to fight this thing from the sky down to the sea floor. They're using airplanes to shower dispersant on the oil slick on the surface. They are putting boom out along the coast and then deep beneath the sea. They are, as you suggest, trying to replace the failed blowout preventer valve to shut this thing off. And they're also moving in two rigs to drill two additional wells, what they call relief wells, with the idea that that will relieve the pressure on the oil coming out of the existing well. But that is the tactic they think is likeliest, sort of the surest tactic to work, but that is the one that's going to take, they say, 2 to 3 months. And, if this thing continues leaking and there's no suggestion, there's no indication that it's likely to slow down at the rate that it's leaking for 2 or 3 months, that's really what has people concerned. And so the stuff that they're trying between now and then are sort of stopgap measures to minimize the ecological damage that the oil does as it comes out, but it doesn't really reduce the amount of oil that's coming out.
And Jeffrey, if you were to take away, I mean, a huge portion of American seafood comes from this area, not to mention all the tourism down there, which is in heavy part dependent on these beaches, not to mention transport up the Mississippi. If you were to stop a big chunk of that, what happens to this region's economy?
Well, look, this region's economy depends to a large degree on two natural resources, seafood and oil. And what we have here is a collision between the two. This is not unprecedented. This area has dealt with oil spills before.
Not like this.
And so I think, no one knows at this point, but there is clearly quite a lot of concern about just what you describe. There's a question about how this is going to hurt the seafood, and there are already suggestions from people in the seafood industry that they're getting calls from people around the country asking whether this stuff is safe to eat. Now, the federal government and the state of Louisiana, they say both in an abundance of caution, implemented various kinds of bans on fishing in the past few days down here, mm-hmm. With an eye toward assuring people that what, in fact, is continuing to come out of the water here is safe. One will have to see how long that impression holds.
We're going to go right to that fishing front. Jeffrey Ball, environment editor for the Wall Street Journal, joining us there from New Orleans. Thank you very much for being with us, Jeffrey.
My pleasure.
Joining me now from Tarpon Springs, Florida, is John Williams. He and his wife operate a small shrimping business. He's executive director of the Southern Shrimp Alliance, which represents the shrimp industry in 8 Gulf Coast states. He's played a major role in facilitating communications between the shrimping industry and the U.S. government through this whole Deepwater Horizon oil spill. John Williams, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So as we speak today, what has been shut down?
What we understand, we work very closely with federal agencies that regulate our seafood in the Gulf and, of course, South Atlantic. To date, so far, what's been shut down from the Mississippi River east to Pensacola, any area under that the sheen or the spill that's on top of the surface. And as we see the spill spreading and expanding, we certainly anticipate further shutdown, more bottom or more fishing shutdown in large, much larger areas.
And this is coming, just as I understand, as you're headed into a pretty important season there.
Yes, as a matter of fact, this, I mean, there's no good time for something like this to happen. But with respect to seafood, especially in the Northern Gulf area, this is probably the worst possible time that something like this could happen. Louisiana season was scheduled to open any day. Same with Mississippi and Alabama. This is the time when our shrimp, for example, you know, we focus more on shrimp because we are a shrimp organization. This is the time when these shrimp move offshore to do their spawning. And while they're moving offshore, we, you know, that's where we begin to work and catch them and produce them and bring them to the hill. And this is a worst possible time, especially for a shutdown, because on the shrimp industry, we need the entire year to survive. You know, we've faced many, many obstacles in the last few years with imports mm-hmm. driving our prices down, hurricanes one after another, high fuel prices like everyone else in the nation. Just a multitude of things, but we were able to keep working during those. This will be a shutdown where we have never experienced, and this will certainly probably cripple not only our industry, but a lot of folks, the oysters, fin fish, you name it, all seafood. It could cripple this entire area.
Cripple, we just got a few seconds before the break, John. Cripple for how long? Is this a matter of months, or are we talking long term, talking forever?
We just don't know, because we don't know what the environmental impact when this oil reaches the shore. That will certainly, you know, it could be years and years. We just don't know yet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the still-spreading oil mess in the Gulf of Mexico. Here's Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano on Fox News Sunday saying the administration is monitoring BP's efforts to repair the underwater leak.
British Petroleum needs to get the spill stopped. We need to do more and be working on the surface of the ocean to make sure that we're doing everything to keep the spill from reaching shore. And then they need to be doing more in terms of protecting shoreline.
Need to, but it is massive, and the oil is still coming up from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Just an unbelievable scene there. We've been talking with John Williams. He's with us from Tarpon Springs in Florida, executive director of the Southern Shrimp Alliance. And with us right now as well from New Orleans is Aaron Viles, campaign director at the Gulf Restoration Network, advocates for sustainable fisheries and habitat protection along the Gulf there. Aaron, you were with us last week when we were earlier on in this, what we called then a disaster. I'm not sure what to call it now. How's the view changed in a week, Aaron?
Well, the spill obviously has grown significantly larger. We're now looking at least 2.5 million gallons of crude that's pumped into the Gulf. It's looming. The projections are really terrifying with the swath of beach and coast and marsh and all these amazingly productive and important ecosystems that are have been affected as we speak and are threatened to be affected as it comes ashore.
I mean, I don't know what to. It's hard to take it on board, Aaron. You know, I mean, as a kid, my family used to drive down on a station wagon to Dauphin Island. You know, right there, in the track of this thing off Mississippi after Katrina. You know, I, like lots of people, were down there working on this coast in the cleanup. And now the tenor of things is that this could be more or less destroyed economically and environmentally, really destroyed.
Yeah, I was talking to a shrimper friend of mine the other day. Lisa Jackson had come and had held a community meeting, which a lot of people were happy to, you know, have some back and forth with the federal government.
The EPA director there, yeah.
Yes, and the shrimper friend of mine walked up to me and said, "Well, Aaron, they finally did it." I said, "What?" He's like, "The oil companies finally killed us. They've been slowly taking away our marsh for really years, decades. We're losing about a football field of marsh every 45 minutes due in part to oil and gas activity in our coastal marshes. But it's like the inverse of Katrina. We're going to have the boats, we're going to have the docks and the ice houses. They'll all be there. Our homes will be there. But there'll be nothing that these coastal communities will be able to do to make a living. We are so concerned about that. And, of course, we're concerned about the environmental impacts. We're getting reports of 20-plus sea turtles washing ashore in the Mississippi coastal area because, again, this is the worst time possible for our nesting sea turtles. They're all swimming in from the Gulf to their nesting beaches. And if you look at that massive blob out there in the Gulf. They have to swim through that to get to where they want to go. And they breathe air. So even if they don't eat any of this, they're going to surface and they're going to breathe in the VOCs. So this is an ecological catastrophe.
What's VOC, Aaron?
Oh, volatile organic compound. Okay. So the stuff that the crude is kind of off-gassing at the surface. There's some toxic impacts to that as well. There's everywhere we look, all the options are bad here. You know, the dispersant has toxic qualities. It makes the oil congeal kind of and drop into the water column where it'll get into more of our habitat, more of our fisheries areas. Or they'll burn it, and then we've got, you know, what we heard last week, Thursday, you were smelling the oil burning in Jazz Fest in New Orleans. So that's, wow, you know, not a great option either, clearly. But none of it works really in bad conditions, which is kind of standard practice in the Gulf of Mexico, bad conditions. So it's clear that BP's drilling disaster is showing us that we have no plan B to deal with these offshore crises when they occur. Not if, when they occur.
Aaron Viles and John Williams, we had a lot of callers for you guys. Susan in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
First of all, hi, John. I'm heartbroken for you and for all of my fellow Gulf Coasters who are going to be affected by this. I'm a Katrina evacuee. That's how I wound up in Amesbury.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a native of Pensacola, Florida. And I grew up with the two nightmare scenarios, the hurricane that would come up the mouth of the Mississippi and destroy New Orleans, and the oil slick that would come and destroy our beaches. And I can't believe they're both happening right now. It's heartbreaking. What I wanted to ask was, I feel like I'm watching the death of my hometown, and it's just killing me. And with all of the economic impact, do you think that the government or somebody will put into place repurposing all of these people who were put out of work to work on cleaning up the oil spill, which is going to take, I agree with John, years and years if it can be done at all?
Yeah. Do fishermen want to do that? And what kind of work would that be? And for how long? John Williams, what about it? BP's doing that right now. How big an answer is that? I mean, can you build an economy on cleaning up from environmental disaster?
I don't know. And thanks, Susan, for the question. I don't know if you could take an entire culture like we have from Brownsville, Texas to Key West, Florida in the Gulf, the shrimp culture, and reposition these folks. A lot of these folks are, you know, the younger generation doesn't seem to be getting into the industry as much as we would like, but a lot of these folks, that's all they know is shrimping or commercial fishing. I don't know if you could position these folks to change that culture, if you will. But certainly BP should, at the very least, hire as many folks as possible to keep them working during a transition or until they can get back to work in what they know. I understand from our folks on the ground, we have folks on the ground from Texas all the way around,
mm-hmm.
Some of our directors, and I understand from this morning's statement BP executive made that they have hired 700 of our vessels now with hopes of hiring 1,000 by the end of today. But I do know there has not been many, and of course a lot of due to the weather, but we have one of our board of directors on a boat now arriving on site as we speak to assist in this cleanup. But I understand there's only been about 12 vessels that have actually been deployed, and he is on one of them.
So big numbers that they're talking about, but only 12 out there. And what a shift. I mean, to go from, you know, bringing in nets full of the abundance of the sea to scooping up tar balls and oil, I don't know if all the fishermen would even want to do that, John. We've got more questions on that front. Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, fellas. Here in New England, we're really close to the sea. So to see this happen to the people on the Gulf Coast, I really got to send a prayer out to these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I have friends who work in the clamming industry, and this is just an outrage, really. And, you know, I know the guy said 5,000 barrels a day, but I've read up to 200,000 barrels of oil being pumped into the Gulf Coast. Who's going to pay for this? Who's going to pay for the mortgage on these guys' houses? Who's going to pay for the boat? Who's going to pay for, you know, the whole community is being, it's an outrage. And I understand oil is a big industry in Louisiana, but it's just an outrage.
Stephen, let us pick it up right there. And John, I know I've got to let you go in a minute, but what about it? BP says it will pay, you know, reasonable and legitimate claims, but as John says, and you point out, these are livelihoods, these are lifetime livelihoods maybe going away. I don't, is anybody going to pay for that? John?
I don't know if BP would be able to pay for that. I understand that there's a $75 million fund set aside to pay for injury or damages, and I think that's federal law. And I understand there's a $1 billion fund set up for additional stuff through all the oil companies. And I got to tell you, this is certainly going to be much greater than that.
John Williams, Executive Director of the Southern Shrimp Alliance, joining us there from Tarpon Springs, Florida. Mr. Williams, thank you very much and good luck. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's go to Robert in Franklin, Kentucky. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes. First of all, I know I'm an opinionated person, so I say that up front. And I will give three opinions, and then I'll wait for some enlightenment. First of all, we Americans are not as environmentally concerned as we appear to be. And secondly, what we want is oil and a lot of it cheaply so it can be converted to gasoline, which we use. And ultimately, I find that there is risk to maintaining our consumer American lifestyle, and that we are basically going to continue taking that risk. So I'll wait for enlightenment.
We all wait for enlightenment, Robert. I appreciate your call. Maybe to help us out here on the enlightenment front, I want to invite in Lisa Marganelli. She's director of the New America Foundation's Energy Initiative, author of Oil on the Brain. She had a piece called The Spill of Our Own yesterday in the New York Times. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us from California, Berkeley, California. Lisa Marganelli, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
You hear our Kentucky caller. He says, you know, here we are staring even at this, the possibility of a great big chunk of our country being kind of despoiled, and he's not feeling confident Americans will pull back from the sort of lifestyle that requires the risk that was taken here.
Well, I agree with him. I understand that he's opinionated, but I completely agree. You know, basically every gallon of gasoline that we use has risks embedded in it, and the risks are of it blowing up, spilling, leaking, the risks of burning it, the risks of air pollution and asthma and respiratory diseases for the people who breathe the pollution from burning it, risks of greenhouse gases, risks for the cost of policing the oil shipping lanes in the Gulf, the other Gulf, the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
We can just go on and on and on about all the risks that are involved in every gallon, and we don't take them into account. You know, what I was listening to stories about the shrimp culture and just feeling terrible because, you know, the Gulf Coast, Texas and Louisiana bear a very different relationship to oil than the rest of us. The Gulf, I believe, produces a quarter of the country's oil. That's
domestic production, something
like that. Yeah, domestic production. And they also refine a third of our gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So basically every
huge
gallon of gasoline that you use has a penalty paid by the residents of the Gulf. I mean, there are places in the Gulf called Cancer Alley. There are neighborhoods near Houston that have such high concentrations of air pollutants that they would be considered hazardous in a federal hazmat site. I mean, they would be worthy of reporting.
But what you're saying, as I read you yesterday, is
mm-hmm.
when we push this offshore, we just kind of push it out of sight, out of mind. Florida Senator Bill Nelson is now calling for an immediate halt to offshore exploration. But you're saying when we have a moratorium here, there's a moral problem because it just gets – the drilling gets pushed somewhere else. And I have to say I was kind of – my mind was kind of blown by one factoid that you shared here, that Nigeria, where an awful lot of oil comes from,
mm-hmm.
has suffered spills, you write, equivalent to that of Exxon Valdez every year since 1969.
Every year. They have 2,000 active spills as of last year. I mean, basically, when we import oil, when we have a moratorium on drilling and we don't reduce the amount of oil that we consume, we then turn to imports. And that means that we import oil and we export spills because there's a risk of spillage in every oil well. Every tanker of oil that comes in has a risk. And those risks accrue in places with less strong environmental laws and with governments that don't have the ability to enforce on those laws. So yes, in my opinion, we've been exporting spills since 1969.
But now we've got it right in our lap. Let's go to New York, Union Springs, New York, and Carlo. Carlo, you're on the air.
I'd just like to shift focus a little. We've had decades of this drumbeat, this mindless chatter about fast growth, regulation has limited growth, and this is what we're getting. We're having fast growth, and then stuff like this happens, this whole idea of regulation, socialism, capitalism. I don't know who's going to address it, perhaps the president, but, the Bush administration, their illegal war sort of overshadowed a lot of stuff they did. You know, he stripped the EPA, the FDA, you name it. And basically, regulation became some bad word, some sort of part of big government. And this is it. We're paying for it, and we're going to continue to pay for it. This whole idea that, you know, I mean, nobody knows. The average person doesn't seem to have a historical sense of, you know, the Triangle Church fire and all that stuff. And people say, well, we fix all that. There's no problem. These problems continue.
Carlo, let us pick it up right there. Lisa, you write about the Minerals Management Service, which is supposed to oversee safety when it comes to oil and oil spills and the kind of weaknesses there, things that might have been done that were not done. What about it?
Right. Well, for this spill in particular, it's possible the Minerals Management Service looked into installing a kind of acoustically triggered valve that would cost about $500,000 on the riser where all the blowout protectors or preventers are. So it would have been an extra sort of fail-safe piece of equipment a couple of years ago, and then dismissed it. Now, Norway uses that equipment. Norway's really interesting because Norway has the exact same situation as the Gulf. They have a very strong fishing industry and a very strong oil industry, and they've had to kind of work through all of that. So they actually have some really good models for environmental controls.
But have we actually become more lax on regulation? That's the opposite of what we heard just a month ago when President Obama was proposing more offshore drilling. We got the sense that the technology and the oversight, you know, were firm.
Liability, you know, here's the question. Is it regulation that does it, or is it intensely heavy liability laws? And we have tons of wells in the Gulf. None of them have had blowouts recently nothing has had a blowout on this scale for a really long time. So the question is were we doing a really good job of regulating? Was the oil industry doing a really good job of preventing them? Was this particular rig incredibly lax? Or was this some insanely freak accident which no one has ever anticipated? We have no idea at this point where we stand on that spectrum. And I'm not even sure politically that it matters. I think that the Minerals Management Service is a pretty messy organization. They have a very, very close relationship with the oil industry, much too close. There was a scandal in 2008 where they were found to be using illicit drugs, apparently having sex with people in the oil industry. Too much information
right
there.
This was Colorado, sort of cocaine and sex and gifts. It was pretty well seen, and that's supposed to be the oversight.
Seedy. But there's a lot more going on with the Minerals Management Service in that it doesn't collect the right amount of money for this oil that's produced on federal lands. And the General Accounting Office also did an extensive series of reports in 2008 looking at that. So there's a whole host of things to be reconsidered. And there's the fact that the U.S., we prefer not to think about oil until there's a disaster. And then we step in and we put in things to prevent the last disaster, but we don't really look ahead to the next one.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the still spreading oil mess in the Gulf of Mexico. Here's President Obama in Louisiana yesterday saying BP would be held accountable for the spill in the Gulf.
BP is responsible for this leak. BP will be paying the bill. But as President of the United States, I'm going to spare no effort to respond to this crisis for as long as it continues. And we will spare no resource to clean up whatever damage is caused. And while there will be time to fully investigate what happened on that rig and hold responsible parties accountable. Our focus now is on a fully coordinated, relentless response effort to stop the leak and prevent more damage to the Gulf.
There's the president yesterday, and you can hear that bad weather behind him that is not making it easy. Aaron Viles is with us. He's campaign director at the Gulf Restoration Network, advocates for sustainable fisheries and habitat there along the Gulf of Mexico. And Lisa Marcinelli is with us from the New America Foundation's Energy Initiative. Let's get a call from Zig in Newton, Massachusetts. Zig, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I worked for the State of Alaska Oil Spill Commission after the Exxon Valdez spill, and we learned a bunch of things. I mean, it wasn't a drunken captain that was the real cause of that. What we said, it was, you know, a culture of complacency, allowing regulation, prevention, all to go lax. There was a need for citizen participation, but there's something people aren't talking about here in the Gulf. Remember, the first oil spill was the Santa Barbara spill in 69,
and
we were astonished by how primitive the management was, but also the cleanup response. 20 years later, in Prince William Sound, we found it was the same primitive technology, and you see it now on your TV screens in the Gulf.
What do you mean, the booms and the sort of, ineffective efforts to stop it? Can it really be stopped? It's the ocean.
They work great if the wind doesn't blow. But as you know, in various parts of the country, the wind occasionally blows. And in Alaska, it took off 1,100 miles down the coast. For BP to have said this was 48 miles off the coast, so any spill would be caught before it hit the coast.
Which they originally said, I guess, yeah.
Right, and that's. But my point is this. Maybe now this is a teaching moment, as you were just saying, to say we should really start working on a technology to capture these hydrocarbons, because inevitably, as you say, with 2,000 platforms in the Gulf or 2,000 wells in the Gulf, there's going to be a spill. In the commission in Alaska, we learned that the Navy has, for instance, some polymer technology that is capable of catching a good part of the hydrocarbons by coagulating them, but apparently people haven't worked much on that technology because what we see on the TV screens is the same kind of stuff that was hanging around in the 60s.
It's easier to say it's not going to happen again because we're on top of it now, and we heard that just in this latest round. I mean, we talked with people in Houston when this was when President Obama came out with his new plan and got these assurances. No, technology's come a long way. Aaron Viles, when you watch the efforts now underway, right under your nose there to try and combat this, do you share Zig's sense that there ought to be a better way? I mean, looking at 7 and 10 foot seas, it's not immediately clear to me. I don't know this business, but how you would stop oil once it's up and out of the well?
Right. I think you know, Zig got it exactly spot on. We have no effective response to a spill like this currently, and I think if before we expand our footprint, we need a better answer. And as we look at the activity in the Gulf of Mexico, we're always going to be fighting, the past war. So I'm sure the blowout preventer valves are going to be fantastic from here on out. But accidents happen in every step of the process. This isn't the first spill we've had in the Gulf. It's this first one that, brought CNN down. Mm-hmm. But we've had significant problems, every single year. So this is the largest, and it's going to be an impact that we're going to be dealing with for years, certainly. But I think before we, expand our footprint, every politician needs to look at what's happening here. They need to look at a shrimper in the eye who's terrified about their future and the future of their community. They need to come and see these dead sea turtles washing up right now and say, I'm willing to say drill, baby, drill some more.
And not to mention the families of those 11 who died on the rig when it blew and sank. What about the non-human cost? Well, we've got you, Aaron. I know we'll lose you in a few minutes, but I mean the crabs, the oysters, the shrimp, the redfish, and that's just what we sort of harvest to eat. What about the wildlife in the face of what's coming?
Well, as I just mentioned, we're seeing the sea turtles right now washing ashore. We know the bluefin tuna are in the area spawning. That they're an endangered fish stock. The Western Atlantic bluefin tuna only spawn in the Gulf of Mexico. We know there's a pod of sperm whales that are in the exact area that this accident happened. They've been seen in the Sheen reportedly. So we know that the impacts are going to be significant to the marine ecosystem. And we've got migrating birds coming to our wetlands right now. This is the kind of high point of the migration, and so we're terribly concerned about those impacts as well. It's about 400 species that are threatened by this. So some of them we eat, many of them we don't, but they're all part of this amazing and robust ecosystem that right now is just absolutely threatened.
Could we somehow dodge the worst case here? I mean, how does it look to you? Is it going to come and strangle all that grass and marsh we see along the coast there? If that happens, what happens? Can we? Might that still be avoided? I mean, this is going to go somewhere.
I hope so. You know, I hope I'm the biggest Pollyanna out there, and I hope that I lose all my credibility. But I look at this bill, and I look at the size of it, and I look at where it's moving, and I have a hard time envisioning any rosy scenario where we don't see vast swaths of the Gulf contaminated for years.
Jim in Charleston, South Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question because I drive a car, and I purchase gas regularly, and in this town, the biggest chain of gas stations and the one I buy from is BP gasoline. You see that BP logo on the station. And I'm wondering, please. Hello?
Hey, hello, Jim, we got you. You're on.
Okay, and I'm wondering, is it wiser for me to use my power as a consumer and take my purchasing power away from BP until this spill is cleaned up as my way of doing my part? Or is that a mistake because they're going to need that money to clean the spill up? Because I don't want to be giving money to a company that's part of this spill. But once again, if me doing that means it's going to hamper the cleanup, then I don't want to do that either.
There's a simple consumer question. Thank you, Jim. Lisa Marganelli in California. What do you say to Jim?
Jim, I think that the answer to all of this is try to use as little gas as possible. If you're not buying it from BP, you're buying it from elsewhere. Basically, BP brings that oil on shore and sells it to other refineries and other companies, and then they buy crude oil from other companies and they pump it out of their refineries. I mean, it's all kind of in a great big pot.
The irony here on the branding front is that BP has been the one who spent I don't know how much to sort of rebrand
$200 million on that Beyond Petroleum thing, which is absolutely which was their slogan for
you call it Orwellian. I mean, they are oil.
It is hilarious. I mean, it's so awful. It's hilarious. You know, Beyond Petroleum. Like, what about them is Beyond Petroleum? Well, the thing is, it's ridiculous, but it really accurately reflects consumers' desires to just fill up our tank with the cheapest gas possible, and then think that we're beyond all that, and then go focus on getting, you know, on recycling and using recyclable plastic spoons and all that sort of stuff, and dolphin-safe tuna. In fact, when you use oil, you are having this enormous impact upon the world. And I think that I don't see anything rosy coming out of this thing in the Gulf. But what we have to do in this country is get everybody aligned to the idea that we have to comprehensively cut back the amount of oil that we consume. And we have to do it with very stringent standards on our cars. We have to have a plan in place. We have to change the timing on our traffic lights. We have to change the speed limit. We have to do everything we can to pull that back and get ourselves on a 30-year plan to dramatically reduce our consumption.
I mean, in fairness, British Petroleum has gone kind of to the hardest spots very often to get oil. It's part of their strategy, as I understand it, you know, to the deepest places. But that's in part because it is consumer demand that wants the gas.
There's consumer demand that wants the gas. BP actually has a history of having some of the worst environmental records over the past 7 or 8 years in
Texas,
the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Texas City refinery fire, which killed 15 people and injured 100.
Mm-hmm.
They had a spill on the North Slope. But there's no indication that that's exactly what's going on here, that it's you know, part of the rest of their culture. We have no idea what caused the spill at this point. But we have to stop mucking about with the business of usual, the posturing of calling for moratoriums. It's fine. We can have a moratorium on all drilling, but we have to reduce the amount that we use. And this is where we're all implicated in this spill.
Aaron Viles, I know we've just got you for another minute there in New Orleans. What were your weekend conversations with colleagues and friends about what the future holds for your city, your region?
I think, by and large, we didn't really want to think about it. We see the worst-case scenario. It's slowly advancing. It's this kind of slow-motion hurricane moving towards us, really. And as the kind of impacts are becoming more and more clear, I think people are terrified about the future of the region because it is so inextricably linked to these coastal systems, the estuaries, the beaches. You know, is this, they talk about maybe getting into the Gulf Stream, we might see impacts all the way down to the Florida Keys. So we're terribly concerned about how these effects are going to really play out in the next six months, 6 years. But we very much hope that, you know, we get a handle on this and that we minimize the impacts and that we really look hard at how we're using the Gulf of Mexico on into the future.
No choice but to hope, but it's a tough hope right now. Aaron Voss with the Gulf Restoration Network. Thanks for being with us again, Aaron.
Absolutely.
Lisa, here's a question from the web. This Mark says that he just heard VP CEO Tony Hayward saying this morning, if he's quoting him accurately here, and I thought I might have heard the same thing, saying this is not our accident, but it is our responsibility. What could he mean by that?
Well, you know, there's sort of a battle going on between all the parties in this. So there's Transoceanic was the drilling contractor that owned the rig.
There's BP, which was the lease,
the oil leaseholder. And then there's the company that made the blowout preventers. And there's also Halliburton, which was cementing the well at the time. And somewhere amongst them, the sort of, you know, the liability is going to be established. So it's hard to know whether BP is, you know, speaking. One does not assume that oil companies speak from the heart in times of crisis.
Yeah.
So one would assume that they are laying down a precedent of saying, you know, this isn't our thing. This would be, this is someone else's thing. And so one of the things that's very interesting about this as an observer is that there's very little information available to us about how this happened or what's being discussed. You have very few of the survivors have spoken to the media. There's essentially kind of a blackout on this.
And the Rush Limbaugh idea that he sort of just floated out there that this was eco-terrorism, does that sound patently absurd to you?
Yeah. I mean, eco-terrorists, what do they normally do? They put a nail in a tree. I don't think that they
destroy the Gulf Coast. That doesn't sound too eco. Fred in Waterloo, Iowa. Fred, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom. I just wanted to say, as a person who typically votes Republican or conservative, my wife and I have both been opposed to this concept of more offshore drilling, the increased nuclear power plants, because it's, as bad as this is, I really think that this is a window into something that could be much more catastrophic in the future regarding nuclear power. And for me, it's just a matter of time. It's a matter of when, not if, but when is one of our high-tech nuclear power plants going to critically melt down and have a real catastrophe? Like I said, this is bad, but I think there's things that are much worse. And I just wish I could convince my friends and my conservative family members and to understand that, you know, this stuff is dangerous stuff we're messing with.
Well, if this isn't the moment that makes us all, whatever stripe, sit back and really think hard, I don't know what is. Fred, thanks for that call. One more right here from Charlotte, North Carolina. Pete, you're on the air.
Yes. Actually, my comment is that I think it's pretty much the peak. Excuse me, the pink elephant in the room is that this happened at a perfect time. It happened more so when they were talking about politics going out there trying to dig more wells in the Gulf, and it's just too ironic, and that's all.
In the drill baby drill era. Yeah, Pete, thanks for your call. What about
it?
Oil
has a tendency to be ironic. It's so big, it's so enormous, its chemistry is so complex, and here we have this thing where we're this incredibly powerful country with all this crazy communications equipment and all these powers, and we're sitting here for days waiting for this spill to hit the coast, and there's nothing we can do.
Could there be a Three Mile Island moment here? Fred in Iowa says, you know, if you think this is bad, think about nuclear. I mean, do you know, it seems 2 minutes ago there was an awful big cry for drill baby drill. Could this turn the country in a different direction? Is it enough, Lisa, as we watch this unfold in the weeks, months, God knows what ahead?
I think that we know we have to do something about our oil consumption. We know we do. And this is a time when we could potentially pull together all the different political players, including the conservation-minded Republicans and the Democrats. This is the moment to make this happen. We know what we're looking at, and we have to do something about it. Aside from the political opportunities here, you know, this spill in the Gulf is just, it's a catastrophe. I mean, there's no way around it. And we're just sitting here waiting for it to hit. It's not, a hurricane, you have the benefit of saying, like, gosh, no one knew that was coming. It all happened so fast. We're just sitting here. And everyone, you know.
People talk about teachable moments, but this could be teachable months, it sounds like, agonizing months, as the country watches this potentially come on shore and keep coming before this thing gets capped.
I will say that to some extent, some of these natural systems have a way of dealing with this, and some of the coastline in Alaska recovered relatively quickly as bacteria and other creatures came in and kind of ate up the hydrocarbons.
We'll take that glimmer, but we're not taking it to the bank quite yet. Lisa Marganelli with the New American Foundation's Energy Initiative, author of Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long Strange Trip to Your Tank, joining us today from Berkeley, California. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. You can read Lisa's op-ed piece yesterday in the New York Times. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.